that you're born an Italian. If you want your life to be great, see that you're born an Italiano and your life will be great.
Hey there, Paisani. Welcome back to another episode of the Italian American Podcast. I'm John Viola, and we are coming to you in the middle of what has proven to be an incredible conversation and a really, really well-received episode. People are going crazy for this. I think it's safe to say this is because we are answering one of the fundamental questions of who we are as Italian-Americans, which is, what is our Italian-American cuisine? What is a red sauce? Because we have today, and we had last week, as many of you listeners will know, a really great guy and a talented author named Ian McCallan, who is the author of Red Sauce, How Italian Food Became American. And this second part of the episode really digs deep into a lot of fun questions, interesting stuff about ingredients and products and dishes that have been lost over time. So I think it's one that everybody's going to really enjoy. So we're going to hop back into where we left off in the conversation, which was Ian's kind of recollections about how pasta and tomatoes came to become a pair and some of the earlier iterations of what the idea of pasta macaroni was before that fateful matching. So hope you guys enjoy, and we'll pick up where we left off.
Well, historically, that was also when you're starting to cook pasta in a way that's very modern, which is to say boiled in water. I mean, they were still doing it for half an hour to an hour, maybe longer, and you're getting very soft things. But up until that point, a lot of, like, a lasagna noodle was very commonly baked in a liquid, often milk. The modern conception of boiling water and pasta is really 150 years old, 200 years old.
You know, it's funny you talk about lasagna, because I did a trip one time with a delegation to Campania, and on one of our official stops, which is, I think, everybody on this show would love to have been a part of, and I'd like to go back, we met with this group called Archeo Cucina, and they basically are chefs and archaeologists, or anthropologists at least, who use everything from whatever written records they have to, you know, how things looked in mosaics or where they were in paintings, this, that, and the other, to recreate historic meals as close as they guess they can get. And we had a Roman lasagna, which they said was, you know, the earliest recorded lasagna. And the filling was pig's udders, ground pig's udders. And like you say, boiled in a milk. And I mean, it was, I didn't find it unappealing. It was definitely not a, you know, grandma's lasagna kind of thing. But I think that, yeah, we have this weird concept of pasta. One of the things I picked up from being about halfway through your book is the idea that, again, we talk about what wasn't here when the Italians got here. Even though we had, obviously, an abundance of wheat in this country, I learned from your book, you still had to send macaroni from Italy because it was a different hardness, I guess. Explain that.
Yeah, so the durum flour, which is a kind of wheat, has a harder kernel around the interior part of the wheat. I'm not a wheat expert, but
that's called fiore. That's like flower of the flower, because there's macaroni producers now in Irpinia who make their macaroni exclusively from that.
Well, so essentially you have different protein levels and different varieties of wheat. And it's classified as hard wheat and soft wheat and different levels of hardness within that. In the breadbasket of America, we primarily were growing softer wheats. Great for bread, great for fresh pasta, not good for macaroni, which you have to dry, right? So the higher protein content of durum wheat allows you to basically have a preserved pasta macaroni product, right? So you were saying, you're joking that you have to say pasta, you can't say macaroni. And really what we're all mostly now eating macaroni, because that refers to anything that has been dried and is shelf stable on your pantry shelf. And that was a very, in the history of pasta, a modern development. You had fresh pasta going back probably before ancient Rome, and probably a lasagna type noodle.
Well, lasagna comes from the Latin word lagunum, and lagunum is the Latin word for noodle. That's why in Napolitan, the word for rolling pin is lagunadura, the pin that you use to roll out the noodle.
So they were concurrent products, lagunum and lasagna, slightly different. And then you also had, the Romans also made a paste that was similar but never developed the gluten.
I never knew this. You're saying Lagunum and lasagna were contemporaries?
It's debated. So there's a lot of historians who go back and forth on this. It seems most likely that it may even go back as far as the Etruscans.
How awesome is it to be an Italian intellectual when you discuss things that actually matter? These are matters that actually count.
Imagine that.
Are they, what would be the word? That they lived at the same time.
Contemporaneous.
Yeah, contemporaneous noodles. Are they, Ian? My question to you, sir, is are they contemporaneous noodles? Is that going to be book number two? Are they contemporaneous noodles?
It's totally, it seems likely. But, think about how many pasta shapes derive from the lasagna shape. Your fettuccine, tagliatelle, all those things are basically thinner and thinner lasagnas, right? And they're a very basic shape to make. You don't get, the cool shaped macaroni until you have a press to press it through. And those had to be initially, I guess the first ones were soft metals, but once you get to a brass shaped.
The bronze ones. I've seen the bronze ones.
Yeah.
In Veneto, they make them. They're like a press.
Well, at that moment, because those things were expensive, the moment you had that come around, that's when you start getting industrialized macaroni happening. At first it was guilds. Guilds were, you had to have a press to join the guild because it was a gatekeeping mechanism, right? The press to squeeze out pasta or to squeeze out the macaroni was expensive. So if you want to join the guild, you have to have one, keep out riffraff. And, very quickly that evolves into Italian macaroni companies making large-scale macaroni, like hundreds and hundreds of different companies. And every single one of them had their own proprietary shapes. And it was a way of distinguishing themselves from the other guy. So the notion, the very quaint notion that every little town in Italy has their own unique shape and every grandmother has their own, not really. It was really a marketing scam from Dolcecco and, Buttini and all these other companies that were making dried macaroni. They wanted to differentiate themselves.
Wow, I didn't know that. You think about it, you could see where some of these shapes that we've become so used to, and of course there's the Italian idea that certain shapes must be served with certain sauces, and this is what takes this. But yeah, I think it's also, like you say, that couldn't be this ancient tradition because you can't make them without industrial tools, right? You just can't. I mean, you can't make these things. I mean, you think of like the whole homemade fusilli. They roll it with the pin. Okay, you can understand that, right? You can understand making a gnocchi but a lot of these things, it's impossible to make without a manufacturer. It's just
Early bucatini, though, which you would think is like a crazy one to make on your own. They actually had pins where they would shove it through a string of pasta to get the hole in bucatini as a manual thing.
Wow.
Which is, to me, is insane.
Like, remember, they had a lot of time.
Yeah.
Like, sure, they were shoving pins through strings of pasta. They had nothing but time.
Do you think they thought that? I have to go wash my clothes in the creek. I want to eat tonight. I have to go gather firewood.
I guess that's true.
I gotta, my sister's getting married next week. I have to have my annual bath. There was a lot. They thought they were busy. I mean, they probably.
I guess that's true.
Can you imagine telling a 1600s housewife, "Do you really have nothing to do but put pens through macaroni?" You want to have that conversation, Ro? I ain't going there.
But why do that then? Like, Ian, did you find any reason why somebody would take the time, even if they were or weren't busy, to run a needle through a pasta before? It doesn't make any
Honestly,
sense.
Honestly, no. The reasoning behind it, no, I do not. Only that people would do it.
I have a theory. You need it so that the whole macaroni, the whole bucatini cooks. If you want a thick pasta that's too thick and you don't run water through it, it's going to become gummy. I'm sure Neapolitan invented it because the Neapolitans love it. Perciatella, bucatini, depending on, different places use different names for the same thing and vice versa. Mm-hmm. But that's my theory with it. But the explosion in what Americans see, like, I think so many non-Italian Americans or Italian Americans who are misinformed, they put it as a superiority. Well, of course, my grandmother made fresh pasta because, box pasta is a convenience. And it's really not. if you had a farm and you had wheat berries that you could grind into flour, you made the macaroni at home because that's, you had no money to buy something. But if you were in a metropolitan city like Naples, where you could not keep wheat around because the rats would be there, and that had constant problems of feeding people. And, you know, the Bourbons had figured out, okay, we should make a dried pasta because that's the best way to keep the rats away. Because if you, and I've said a million times on the show, but God knows John probably edits out all the time, you know, flour at the time would go rancid very quickly. So you had to mill it every couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
And large deposits of flour had vermin problems. So the Bourbons realized to keep the city of Naples stable, the best way to conserve flour was to make it into macaroni. And that's why the Bourbons put so much money into the development of macaroni, because it was to shore off starvation. But, you know, with the world that's going, with the stuff going on in the world today, with the war in Ukraine, O Sole Mio was written by a Neapolitan in Odessa because he was a flour merchant buying durum wheat semolina from Ukraine to bring to Naples to make, because Naples didn't produce enough of its own flour. Italy didn't produce enough of its own flour to give enough of Italians macaroni.
Well, that was partly why Mussolini under fascism was trying to get people to stop eating pasta. It didn't work. They rejected that one.
Did he really? I never knew that.
Yeah. So, you know,
Duce used to go a little wacky with stuff like that at times. Like stuff like he had a lot of bizarre, like, you know, like, how did he think he was going to pull that one off?
So, yeah, it was just, you know, the fascists as a statement had a lot of ideas about food. And then Mussolini himself had some weird food stuff. Like he had digestive problems, I think. But yeah, he was anti-pasta, not for any other reason other than he essentially wanted to retain as much wealth, which is to say exporting more goods than you're going to import as a country, right? So they wanted to grow wheat and export it for hard currency. And the way to do that was to make Italians eat more bread, which can use soft wheat, which is easier to grow and has a higher yield. And, you know, it's why Americans grew it in the bread basket, is soft wheat. You get a lot more kernels of wheat for every stalk on a soft wheat than you do durum wheat. So that was part of the fascist plan, was not allowing people to eat pasta. But didn't work.
Of the many questionable decisions coming out of the fascist era,
would you put that up with invading Ethiopia?
Yeah, it's up there with bad ideas.
Bad
that
ideas,
is,
like
yeah,
trying to breed the U.S. and England in a war.
Yeah,
and yeah, that's kind of the same.
In a collection of some real doozies,
Duce's big bloopers. I think we could put that in there.
None of the best hits of the Duce bloopers. I think to me, you know, I look at a lot of these pasta brands that sprouted up here in the United States, right? Because at some point, we do start making this stuff indigenously here, and you know, there's some of them survive. La Rosa pasta, and there's a few brands that are still around.
Prince
spaghetti, Prince is still around.
Well, these are wildly regional, and it's kind of incredible. Like Prince is mostly in Boston and Massachusetts. I think it's harder to get in New York. I haven't seen it.
Oh yeah, it's definitely harder to get. Yeah,
I haven't seen it.
But they survive. These indigenous businesses,
yeah,
many of them survive regionally, but it also brings up other ingredients that start to be made and manufactured here and evolve here that weren't available. I'm thinking in particular, the other day I've been buying up old Italian American cookbooks or recipe books from like charities or companies and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been, you know, just sorting through them. And I found one from Palio Cheese from the 50s, which was in Brooklyn at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically a primer explaining to an American audience how to use and eat ricotta and mozzarella. And it's basically like, you wouldn't believe it, but you can eat these things. And I thought to myself, wow, we didn't even, like, I couldn't even imagine that would be so foreign to people. But, you know, what other ingredients were sort of sprung up in the Italian-American business sphere and became localized, like a Palio?
Well, I mean, what I thought, you know, speaking of cheese, one of the things I found fascinating is, have you heard of Bel Paese cheese?
Bel Paese, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It was one of like five or six cheeses that was commonly known as Italian in the first half of the 20th century. You know, like if you look at ladies' magazines that were talking about, oh, the ethnic Italian foods, this is what you need to know about about cheese, right? They'd have mozzarella, they'd have Parmesan, maybe they would have Romano, maybe. They have maybe provolone, and then the bella pesce would be on it. And you know what? I personally had never had it until I started doing this research and went looking for it and couldn't find it. I did find it in a grocery store in Massachusetts, but yeah, it's funny to me how, you know, some of these cheese like mozzarella surpassed cheddar in the United States a few years ago for like production, you know, so we now eat and consume more mozzarella than cheddar.
Wow.
Probably through pizza. Right. But, you know, that's incredible, right? You know, 100 years ago, you couldn't find fresh mozzarella outside of a handful of Little Italy's.
But, you know, the other thing, too, is that in Clarity, it was a product that was only eaten by people who had connections to Naples, Sorrento, mm-hmm. Caserta, and Salerno. You know, the same gentleman, Vincenzo Contarelli, told me the same story. He told me that when he came to Jersey City in 1952, when he immigrated from the Cilento, he got a job at Fiori's Mozzarella in Jersey City. And the owner told him he was going to make mozzarella. And because he was living actually upstairs from the store, he had no idea what it was. Mm-hmm. He thought it was some type of baked, like lasagna type of dish. And he goes, we were in the Cilento. The only cheese I knew was the fresh cheese my mother made every day.
Wow.
Now, him writing to Battipaglia, if you go from Vattola to Battipaglia now, it's probably a half hour drive.
Mm-hmm.
Yet to him, mozzarella was unknown in the 50s, right after the war.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, if you were in an area like New Orleans where you had Sicilians or, you know, West Virginia, where it's all these people from Calabria, they would have had no idea what mozzarella was. It was a hyper regional product from Campania.
Well, and it was in the United States at first. More generally, it was known as the pizza cheese. Like, it was literally called pizza cheese in a lot of places. Not now you use that phrase usually to imply that it may not be like actually mozzarella.
Right.
But initially, a lot of people would refer to it that way because that's how they first encountered it, you know.
Well, and this bel paese cheese that you mentioned, is this a brand of cheese or a type of cheese?
It is a type of cheese, I believe.
Is it like a soft cheese?
Yeah, it's a super soft cheese. They're individually wrapped. If I had to liken it to some American counterpart, it's like Laughing Cow cheese.
Yeah.
That is an insult to the bel paese cheese.
And Ro, do you still get it?
Yeah, you can find bel paese, sure. You can find it.
Yeah, it was in a little gold wrapper. I remember it.
But you can't just walk into any grocery store and find it, right? You walk into any grocery store in America, Whole Foods across the country, Parmesan, probably ricotta now. Although not as easy as you might think. Parmesan, mozzarella is definitely there, probably Romano, but the bel paese is a little more difficult.
I'm gonna have to try this. I don't think I've ever. I must have encountered it somewhere, but it's unfamiliar to me. I find this.
I remember it very well. It was in a gold wrapper with like a green, white, and red, classy green, white, and red label on top. But they were very small, Ro. Am I correct?
They are. They're little wedges. They're either like, so Laughing Cow is sold in a wedge. These are sold in little round forms. Usually there's wax around it that you like peel and it comes off. And then it's really good melted into pastina.
Mm.
That's how a lot of people eat it.
Now I'm hungry. That sounds perfect to me. But it's so amazing to me to think that, like, you're talking about, you know, Good Housekeeping magazine in you know, nearly 100 years ago. Talking about these products, I found one of the things you mentioned in the book, and this reminds me of it, is, you know, if this is an ingredient that was once one of the early sort of Italian ingredients that became mainstream but has disappeared essentially or has you know, kind of gotten lost with time, you mentioned in the book that you encountered a lot of recipes that were lost by now, even red sauce recipes that had developed. Any of those that you can think of off the top of your head that were sort of, you know, at some point far more popular, far more indicative of Italian-American cuisine that are no longer really available?
Well, the one that I mean, I can understand why, but spaghetti alla Caruso, right? This is a red sauce that has chicken livers in it most of the time.
Oh, I love chicken livers.
Well,
why you gotta beat up on chicken livers? Why am I the only, I love chicken livers and potatoes.
I like chicken livers too.
Don't drink the Kool-Aid, Ian.
I love a deep fried liver, right? Like a sweet bread type thing. But you know, I'm not sure how I feel about it in a red sauce. I've never made it. I've never had it. Part of me was like, I should try to make it, but you know, convincing my wife I'm going to make a liver-based red sauce was a step too far for her.
Is your wife Italian?
She is. She is. Well, she's half and half like me.
You gotta tell. She gotta do this for the good of the tribe. It's a sacrifice of real people, the historic integrity of our nation.
Well, what's incredible about it? So the story with Spaghetti alla Caruso is it basically comes about when Enrico Caruso, the opera singer, is in New York. And he was singing at the Met and among other places, but New York was his like home base in America. And he was a huge celebrity. And he ended up going, he liked the Knickerbocker Hotel. He lived in the Knickerbocker for a while. And there are a couple other restaurants he would frequent. Also, he was a friend of the founder of Mama Leone's, the big red sauce place from Times Square. I actually encouraged her to open a restaurant initially. And so anyway, he liked the liver because he thought it helped his voice, right? He believed it gave him stamina to sing and brought out the sound of his vocal cords. And so he would eat a spaghetti alla Caruso, not then called that, but he at this one restaurant that started renaming it. And this is actually where there's a little bit of a conflict, right? So the famous chef, Louis DeGoy, from the Knickerbocker Hotel, wrote the Gold Cookbook, famous recipes from the Knickerbocker Hotel. He claims that spaghetti alla Caruso does not have liver, but almost every other spaghetti alla Caruso recipe will have it. And Caruso talks about the importance of liver for him. But this is a dish that by the 1920s is like a very standard across many red sauce joints. And then even, I don't know if you ever looked into the various menu archives, the New York Public Library has a great old restaurant menu archive, mostly from New York, but some are like cruise ships and things like that. Spaghetti alla Caruso was very popular up until the early 1960s. On menus, at least. I don't know if people were ordering it. And I think it probably has to do with general changes in the way we consume food, where, you know, chicken liver was a thing that was very common because it's a low-cost meat, right? It's like essentially a leftover organ. It's an organ meat of some kind. And if you can afford to not have chicken liver, most people typically will have a steak instead, or even like a chicken cutlet rather than a chicken liver. And I think what basically happened is it fell out of favor, and now it's very hard to find spaghetti alla Caruso after, you know, decades of it being everywhere. So that's definitely one.
Well, it's funny you say that because we haven't released it yet, but coming out in, I guess it'll be the next episode out of Greetings from Italian America, where Pat, Roe, and I travel around the country to eat and explore our way through Italian America. Mm-hmm. You know, we did a 4-5 city swing through California last summer. And when we got to LA proper, one of the things I really wanted to do was eat at this place called Maselli's in Hollywood, which is a, you know, mm-hmm. over the top Italian American red sauce joint, neon sign, and decorated like a Swiss village. I mean, it's everything I love as much as the other two. Would rather go to the sort of better rated restaurants today.
That's not true. You've won us over in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you guys have been great about it. I my point being, it's you know, this is like my pilgrimages, right? And sure enough, what was on the menu? And I don't remember. I can't recall if it was called Spaghetti Caruso or not, but it was spaghetti with chicken livers and a tomato sauce. And I ordered it, and we tried it. And I just think my experience with it, unfortunately, was. I'm not quite sure they prepare it a lot, so I think they just overcooked it a little bit because it was a little burnt. Mm-hmm. But I may have to take a second bite at that apple and go over there for that.
I'm going to write a memoir one day called All the Places John Viola Made Me Eat At.
Come on, you love him.
All the places John Viola forced me to eat food at.
You've always found one good thing at each of them.
I did. And Michelli's, believe it or not, made very good spaghetti agno olio.
Yes, they did. That's right. Yeah. And they made the weird 50s cocktails, right? Pat had the grasshopper.
Grasshopper.
Yeah. And I think Stephanie had a fuzzy squirrel or navel or something.
She had a pink squirrel, which is the same cocktail that Fran Drescher drank season one of The Nanny. And there could be no more appropriate cocktail for Miss Stephanie.
Yeah, I had a fun night there. But yeah, I was so thrilled to see that on the menu. So it's amazing that you bring that up.
Yeah.
Any other good lost recipes that we've foregone?
I mean, so I think we probably have lost. You can still get a version of it, but lobster fra diavolo.
Yeah, you don't see it.
Well, and when you do see a fra diavolo sauce, right? It usually now today that usually indicates shellfish, right? Not always, but sometimes spicy shellfish, right? And the original lobster fra diavolo was a whole lobster with some spicy tomato sauce-ish type thing on it, alongside usually a spaghetti, not now like a sauce that's mixed on it, but like pasta and protein side by side. And then over time, it became first a lobster, like a whole lobster taken out of the shell and placed on top of the pasta. And then, you know, lobster became more expensive over time. Pieces of lobster, maybe pieces of lobster and pieces of crab or shrimp. And now, like I said, it's no longer, no one calls it lobster fra diavolo anymore. Now it's fra diavolo sauce, which usually has a shellfish component, but not necessarily. And that to me is an amazing 110, 120 year evolution of a dish that is very clearly an American dish. There is no relative or similar dish, in part because lobsters were very expensive in the Mediterranean, even 200 years ago, 150 years ago. Whereas in America in the 19th century, the lobsters were so prevalent. You know, there were laws restricting how often you could feed them to your servants. Actually, concurrent with the rise of Italian American restaurants in New York, they had lobster palaces where like the bankers of the day would go to show off and get their equivalent of bottle service. It would be champagne and like a lobster. And that would be a little showy type thing to do. It was kind of closed down certainly by the era of Prohibition, because half the fun was getting smashed on champagne, right?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it's crazy to think of even American ingredients and how they've changed. Mm-hmm. I remember somebody saying lobster used to be fed to inmates in prisons because mm-hmm. it was so abundant, yeah. and now it's this delicacy. And, you know, I haven't finished the book, as I've said, so I don't know if you cover this or even if you know the answer, but I was watching a TV show, and somebody mentioned a dish, which I has to be an Italian-American invention, if it's got Italian Americans behind it at all, called turkey tetrazzini. Have you heard of this?
Yes, I've heard of it. And I've never made it and I've never had it, but I got to do it.
What is this?
So its original incarnation is probably vaguely Italian influenced. The current, what you would see now is basically a casserole usually. And the evolution of that is incredible. So it's not red sauce per se, but tetrazzini was an opera singer as well. She came over to New York, met up with Caruso in New York at certain points. I think they sang together once or twice at the Met, but she was also a celebrity. I mean, people loved opera in turn of the century. So she was a celebrity as well. I think she actually, she may have gone to San Francisco as well. It might be where the origin was, but basically it's a cream. The original version is like a cream sauce with mushrooms and a couple other things. And either turkey or chicken, not totally sure the preparation of the meat part of it. But over time, it evolved from what I just described into a casserole, which is a very different beast. So there are elements of it that are vaguely Italian. And what amazes me about modern Italian food or modern Italians is how much they love turkey. Mm. Yeah, at least in my experience with them, relatives and so on, they love turkey. I don't know why, but
I never even thought about encountering turkey in Italian cuisine. That's when I read this thing about it, I watched this video, whatever it was, I'm thinking, where's this turkey preparation come from? So I'm glad to know it was, again, a restaurant-driven one for a celebrity. That makes a little bit more sense, actually, mm-hmm. The Italianness to it. You know, you got me thinking now about all these red sauce joints, and I am sort of going in my mind through the staples that I look for, right? The oftentimes red checkered tablecloth, at least a nice white one, the Chianti or the carafe of house wine, and right. And one of the things I thought about was, I don't know if I've ever seen salt and pepper, the American version, on a table at a red sauce joint, but you always see a grated cheese and a crushed red pepper.
Mm-hmm.
Any kind of insight into why those two things are always on the table? And somebody once told me it's not necessarily Parmigiana in the cheese. It might be Romano. It might be Pecorino. Like, where's that come from? How did these become the Italian-American salt and pepper, if you will?
So the easier one on that is crushed red pepper. A lot of recipes don't include red pepper or chili pepper as an ingredient. A lot of, especially Southern Italian cooking, is really the way you salt and pepper a dish that you're making, you throw in crushed red pepper. So it's like spice to taste, right? And so I would come to believe that's probably why crushed red pepper is on a dinner table in that capacity, because it is spice it to your taste. The cheese element is I think more interesting, because Parmesan Reggiano is a gold standard around the world, that, you know, it's like what all cheeses should be measured against. And it is more of a, it's definitely more American to sort of slather huge amounts of it over your pasta. Obviously a little bit here and there. Yeah, I think it's like an interesting observation that you do see that in restaurants. I think more recently, and it's probably a sign that it's higher quality, is serving it tableside, because you're getting less of it, right? So instead of just letting you free reign to dump that entire thing of Parmesan or Romano onto your pasta, the waiter comes around and gives you a spoonful or grades it in front of you. And that's probably an indication that the quality of it is higher than what is on the table, right?
Mm.
You know, just because of cost and like a proper Parmesan Reggiano wheel, you know, thousands of dollars, right? You know, even the Parmesan that we're getting here probably disqualifies itself as Parmesan Reggiano in Italy. Right. Like, even though it says Parmesan Reggiano on the rind, right, it probably meets some kind of imperfection, you know, let's say, that the Italians would say that is no longer officially a Parmesan. So, yeah, cheese is a big deal. So I love a good Parmesan. Right.
Yeah, I find that really fat. I remember, like, I think Kraft makes a Parmesan product, mm-hmm. or something like that. And it's not even.
It's called cheese product or cheese food.
But it's not cheese, right?
No, it's not cheese. I mean, no, it's sawdust. You can't call that cheese.
But yeah, it's got no dairy in it.
Well, you want to know the real scam? When you buy imported Parmesan, not Parmesan, right? That imported Parmesan might be imported from Argentina, not from Italy.
Really?
A lot of people don't think about that, right? So you can't call it Parmesan Reggiano, right? But you can call it Parmesan, right? Like Wisconsin Parmesan, but imported Parmesan implies a certain quality, you know, a certain...
You can't call it Parmigiano unless the cow speaks Italian.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's it. But the Italians have done a lot of work around that. I mean, there's been whole movements, and you know, unfortunately, it brings up this exact question we're talking about, right? What's Italian, what's Italian-American? Because the Italians have started to advocate and create not laws, but efforts,
mm-hmm.
to stop places like Wisconsin claiming that they make Parmesan. But unfortunately, caught up with that DOC type protection is a lot of these Italian American products that have been made here for 150 years, right? Like, you know,
mm-hmm.
Bel Gioioso cheeses and Palio, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
where's the line? Is an Italian American product authentic? I mean, for example, one of our early episodes of Greetings from Italian America, we went to New Haven,
mm-hmm.
and we went to Liuzzi Cheese. And they took us to their factory, and they told us that they have imported the water buffalo from Campania, and they're making domestic American buffalo mozzarella. Now, for me, if I see it on a menu at an Italian place, when it's imported here from Italy, it just doesn't hold up. It's got that bitter acidity from the mm-hmm. preservation. You just can't eat it more than a couple hours away from where it's produced.
Mm-hmm.
But here's this place in Connecticut making an American version. Does that qualify? Are the Italians going to come after that? I mean, you know, where's the line between Italian and Italian-American? And I think we have a legitimate cuisine of our own, and I think we have to advocate for it.
I totally agree.
No, we do have a legitimate cuisine of our own, and that's what I try to explain to people, is that Italian-American cuisine is its own cuisine, and we don't play by the rules of authentic Italian cuisine because we don't have to. Like, who are you to tell us how we have to cook? Like, we came here, we immigrated, we struggled, saved our money, we could cook whatever we want, put whatever however much cheese we want on something. Like, leave us alone.
Well, I also think what is authentic, but what people eat day to day in their lives. Like, what do you cook for your kid at the end of the day, right? That's authenticity, right?
That's what I like to tell people. If you make it in your everyday life, it exists. You started your own tradition, mm-hmm. and that's it. That you don't need anything else.
Yeah. I mean, one of the first things we fed, I have a one-year-old. One of the first things we fed him that was not milk was tomato sauce. It was actually, may have actually been paste, because I think I was opening up a paste can. But yeah. And then pasta. And that, you know, that was traditions that we grew up, my wife and I grew up eating pasta several times a week. You know, she talks about getting pizzas on Friday because it would be no meat Friday, theoretically. And yeah, and so those are the traditions. That is what is authenticity, right?
Yeah.
Whatever your combination is.
Yeah, it's funny. We've been introducing solid foods to the baby, and I could not wait till we could do. We just did tomatoes last week, and I was so excited because I have nephews and nieces that, like, a lot of them don't eat tomato sauce on macaroni when we eat it. And, like, you know, I guess it's normal for kids. Maybe there's something about tomatoes. I want it with butter, or I want it with this. But I've got one niece who just goes nuts for it. And so I'm trying to make sure my daughter is not in the anti-tomato on pasta camp right away. You know, I want to get her trained. So as we draw to the close of what I think is going to be two fantastic episodes, I figure a great way for us to close out the conversation is first and foremost to say, Ian, you are welcome back anytime on the Italian American podcast.
Love it.
We'd love to have you, and we'd love to take you out for a night of red sauce at a restaurant that of your choosing, whatever you think would be indicative of this great cuisine. And I think it's a good way to close to ask each of us, what is your top red sauce menu item? What is your go-to if you're on the way to the electric chair and the menu comes from a red sauce joint? What's the one thing you're eating?
Well, I mean, I'm definitely torn between a really good spicy, because I like it spicy, pasta vodka sauce. I don't care what pasta goes into it. I do want it to have the red chili pepper flavor to it. Or, I mean, it's hard to beat a veal parmesan, like a real big flat, the size of the plate, right? They took that little veal and beat the hell out of it until it got to be enormous and broiled it for just the right amount of time to get that golden brown bubbly on top. Yeah, that. So, maybe a veal parm with a side of penne alla vodka.
Okay, that's fair. You can do side of pasta. I think that's absolutely fair because that's how you would order in a restaurant, in a red sauce joint in particular. So, Ro, what's your go-to?
Chicken marsala.
Really? What kind of pasta on the side?
I like a good chicken marsala with a little aglio olio on the side.
You do like aglio olio, don't you?
I do like it. You know, what's not to like? But it's the
It's fast food.
It's the rice side dish of Italian America.
You're right about that. That's true. My father's nuts for aglio olio, and he's very picky about it. There's something like a standard.
You can put a saucy thing with the marsala.
That's very true.
Yeah, but I can't eat macaroni as a side dish. I got to have it as a first course followed by something.
Mr. Frenchman can't have.
No. Troppo signore, troppo signore. If I went to one of those places where they'll say, we'll give you a veal parm with a side of spaghetti, my spaghetti has to come first.
Okay, so what are you ordering first? And then what's your main course?
I love shrimp parm.
You do?
Oh, yes. My God. Oh. Cheese and seafood?
Oh.
You've broken all the rules.
Arrest him.
The fish and the cheese do not go.
They do in Italian America.
They do in my world.
And while I am very, very much pro-Italian America, I do believe in my heart of hearts that not everything is supposed to be parm.
Yeah, but they would eat. The Italians, off the real Italians, turn their nose up on stuff because they refuse to try it.
Yeah, that's true.
They are the most closed-minded people. No, You could put
the thing that this country promises is the pursuit of happiness. So you have every friggin' right to palm anything you want, but it doesn't mean that you should.
I have never in my life had an episode where you got this worked up. You're like, am I right or wrong, John?
She's on a. Well, this is a big thing. Ro encounters this a lot.
But this is touching the heart.
You know, as a shrimp parm that I would be excited to try. You ever been to Park Avenue Deli? It's like 45th Street in Midtown.
Nope.
No, we'll do it though. John and I will be there like Thursday.
Oh yeah, check it out. It's a place I would go for work lunch, and I would usually get a chicken parm. But on the right days, they would have a shrimp parm, and a couple times, you know, they almost convinced me to get it. So
I don't like the shrimp parm with a lot of mozzarella. I like a fried shrimp baked in the oven with the tomato sauce. That's like my bada boom moment. Like with not, because some people go overboard with mozzarella and it takes over.
What's your pasta?
I mean, it's always spaghetti with these things. I mean, or you know, no, know what I really like? I like the real, the baked ziti, the kind of vodka sauce. Yeah, I could go vodka. Yeah, I would go vodka sauce and the shrimp parm.
Yeah.
But I also like that kind of baked ziti where there's too much ricotta and too much mozzarella. And the macaroni is so overcooked and baked in the oven, it's kind of like
crispy,
falling apart. Yeah.
I don't know. I think for me, the macaroni would be a hard one. I'm a vodka sauce guy. I love vodka sauce. That might be my go-to, honestly. As a main dish, though, if I'm in a red sauce joint, I think a good veal chop and vinegar peppers is my, like, if I'm going to the chair, that's what I want my last meal.
It's got to be a good pork chop. It's got to be fatty. Sometimes I use these dry pork chops. I love the veal and vinegar peppers, but it cannot be, it's got to be a fatty, it's like this frionzolo, the cilantro's frionzolo, that fatty piece of pork.
Yeah.
No fat, no, if it's fatty and with the vinegar peppers, you're in paradise.
And it's got to be broiled. You got to get that real crisp. And I cannot stand the idea that a lot of restaurants cheap and use like, you know, like the bell peppers in like the, like, oh, they're not vinegar peppers. They're like jarred peppers.
No, you can't cheat those. You can't.
It's got that. You need that vinegar, yes. Real heavy, like vinegar, that bite to it. And if you don't have, like, there's been plenty of places where I've ordered and I'm like, they're just giving me the cheap red pepper strips. And that's,
but you know, part of the problem is, and this is, don't go flipping out on me because some people out there, listen to what I'm saying with this. You went from having Italian Americans who cooked in the kitchen, who grew up with the food and knew it. And now you have mostly South Americans who are phenomenal at their own food, but they don't have that intrinsic sense. Like they wouldn't know if you're coming from Oaxaca, you don't know, like the same thing I would know about Oaxacan cuisine, right? Or Pueblano cuisine. I don't think they have enough of a background to know what a vinegar, that you have to use vinegar peppers. And I think a lot of times people open these restaurants as commercial ventures. And these guys learned how to cook from other places that they cooked. And they don't have the home court advantage that we had when we had an Italian in the kitchen.
Well, it also speaks to the idea that, like, again, a dish like that is created in a time and place of Italian immigration, heavy Italian immigration, or, you know, the first wave of integration into the country. And, you know, if you open up a place now, yeah, there's not the sort of, it's not standard fare for everybody anymore. So it is for those of us who grew up eating it. But for a lot of people, if you think of a pork chop or a veal chop and peppers, it's just veal and peppers, right? It doesn't really matter.
No, it's got to be a vinegar pepper. Do you know where that veal and vinegar peppers comes from?
No.
It came from pork and vinegar peppers, and that was made when you would slaughter the pig in January. So the fresh pieces of, I think it was usually around the neck of pork, the parts you didn't salt for preservation, that was the big, we just killed the pig, let's have fun, was cooking it with, because the vinegar peppers would have been preserved the summer before. So they would have been steeping for 6 months, and you had the freshly killed piggy. And the piggy and the peppers are yummy, yummy, yummy together.
Yes, they are.
Ian, before you go, I'm going to give you my contact information. Okay. I got to find out. You don't know where they're from, your ancestors particularly?
My grandfather is from Bagnoli del Trigno in Molise. He and all of his cousins have a handful of similar last names. And they went to Clifton, New Jersey, Youngstown, Ohio, and a place in Canada. And then my mother's family, Naples and Sicily, the Neapolitan stories that my mother has, or basically they're the most obscure, is they were very wealthy in Naples, had servants, and then one day just left. And in America, they scrubbed other people's houses and were the servants. And I'm really curious why they left. If they had the money and the wealth in Naples,
text me.
Yeah,
text me. We'll do this because I have so many viewers out there. We'll get this. I might not get everybody, but we'll get this. Am I right or wrong, John? Have I not done it before?
No, this is Pat's specialty. If there's a genealogical conundrum you can't solve, text Pat and he will make.
Sometimes it's very easy, and sometimes it's hard. Sometimes I hit roadblocks, but sometimes it's very easy.
75% of the time, you break through though. You've got a bevy of resources and an understanding. I think that's you know. Incomparable. So yeah, he's good at this.
I'm intrigued.
Good. You've come to the right place.
Text me. I'll give you my number.
Well, Well, I think
I start. I need last names. All right, Johnson, cut me off. I want to go eat. I've been fasting 2 hours. He didn't pick. This is a 2 hour taping. So he picks the day that I'm intermittent fasting and decides at 3 o'clock, we're going to have a 2 hour conversation about eating.
Think how much better that's going to taste.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Eating that pasta.
That's why it's like really easy to get me off this plate. I'm like, yeah, I got to go eat now.
I'm going to get pork chop and vinegar peppers. That's I'm going to, I got to get that. That's like on my mind now. So I got a woolly.
You got the woolly. You got the woolly.
I got the woolly.
You got the woolly.
Yeah, I got to have that. Well, Ian, it's been a real pleasure.
I had a blast.
But so did we. I know I speak for all of us.
We are so proud on behalf of the Italian people of New Jersey that once again you prove to the 718 people that we are the true superior masters of Italian America. They're the past and we're the future.
Whatever.
Yeah, I saw it.
Right. Well, I'm gonna take Pat's job because Pat usually advocates that you go out and buy the book. But I'm going to say, as somebody who's about halfway through it right now, you must go out and get Red Sauce, How Italian Food Became American. I promise you, it will. It's first of all, it's a beautiful book. It's got a beautiful cover. It sticks out on a shelf. But it will absolutely hold pride of place in your Italian-American collection. I think this is going to go down as one of those must-reads for Italian-Americans, and it's certainly going to be added to my must-read list. So having Ian on, absolutely an open invitation to come back anytime. We hope everybody out there has had as much fun as we have over the course of these two episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
See that you're born an Italian, if you want your life to be great. See that you're born an Italiano, and your life will be great. See that you're born an Italiano.